In the book of Romans, the 15th chapter and verse 4, Paul wrote, "For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope." The same apostle, by inspiration, wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, beginning with verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, I didn't want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food, all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters, as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall." No word that I know of in any language gets attention and sparks interest more than the word lost. A lost child causes an entire community, sometimes an entire state, and sometimes the nation to become frantic in searching for this lost person, this lost young person. And the Lord understood the meaning of this. In fact, he told of the lost sheep of the house of Israel in Luke chapter 15. He also talked about the lost coin, and he talked about the lost boy, the lost son. But what Jesus stated about this business was, he came to seek and to save the lost. And you know, in the entirety of inspiration, one of the most tragic accounts is that of a lost generation. And it looks to me like my fonts didn't line up here. But a lost generation, an entire generation that failed to enter the promised land that we read about in Numbers chapter 13 and 14. Just to give a brief summary, after their long bondage in Egypt, God delivered Israel by a mighty hand. He brought them through the Red Sea. He led them to Mount Sinai. He gave them the law and fed them with manna from heaven. God very graciously saw to their needs and led them up to the promised land. To reassure them of the promised land of rest, God told Moses to send out 12 spies to inspect the land and give their report. In Numbers chapter 13, the first two verses, we read, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers, you shall send a man, every one, a leader among them." Now, I want you to notice something here. Here's what they were sent out to do. First of all, they were sent out to see its inhabitants. They were to see whether they were strong or whether they were weak. What's the condition of them? They were to check the cities, to see if they were walled cities or if they simply lived in cities made of tents, and to examine its soil as to its fertility and its potential productivity. And they completed their assignment, but they went too far in presenting conclusions that they had reached and offering recommendations to the people of Israel. Now, this was not something that was in their jurisdiction. It was not theirs to say one way or the other about whether or not these people could be conquered. But I want you to notice with me here about the spies' reports. We notice the majority report is summed up over here in Numbers 13, verses 27 through 33. Now, by this, we're talking about the ten spies that were sent into the land. They said, "We went to the land where you sent us, and it truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large, and moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there, the giants. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan." Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we were able to overcome it." But the men who had gone up said, "We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out. "The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, who came from the giants. And we are like grasshoppers in our own sight. And so we were in their sight." Now this is the report that the majority of spies gave. 10 out of 12. That's the majority. Now when you consider their report, and keep in mind that God had promised them this land, you have to say, well, now, just a minute. Why did they come back with a report like that? Especially since whenever we look at the minority report, just 2 out of the 12, given by Joshua and Caleb. Again, Numbers 14, verses 6 through 9, Joshua the son of Nun, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who spied out the land, tore their clothes and spoke to the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey." Now listen to their plea. "Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." Now that's a big disparity between the minority report and the majority report, isn't it? A big disparity. But you know, whenever you realize that the majority were afraid to go into the land and take it, and we read, of course, about what happened to them, you have to wonder, well, now, what was it that caused this whole generation to be lost? That's what we were reading about in our introduction, wasn't it, this evening? Why were they all lost? Well, summing it up, we might say one of the reasons was is they drew back. Now, what we mean by this, they refused to go up and possess the land. They drew back instead of going forward. And consequently, God withdrew his promise to them. In Numbers 14, beginning verse 26, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "How long shall I bear with this evil congregation who complain against me? I have heard the complaints which the children of Israel make against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. The carcasses of you who have complained against me shall fall in the wilderness. All of you who were numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun, you shall by no means enter the land which I swore I would make you dwell in. But your little ones, whom you said would be victims, I will bring in, and they shall know the land which you have despised. But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in the wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years, and bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness. According to the number of the days which you spied out the land, 40 days. For each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. I, the Lord, have spoken this. I will surely do so to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die. Now, how could God make that any clearer? God said, I'm not going to let this go unnoticed. No way. Every one of you will die in the wilderness above 20 years of age. Every one of you, with the exception of only two. Now, you know what that means? A whole generation was lost. Those who had drawn back and murmured against God died in the wilderness. Because God said, this is what I'm going to do to you. Well, you know what? This, when we remember what the purpose of the Old Testament is, it's not just, you know, to give us something to read or for our entertainment, but it's there to teach us something. We have to consider the consequences of drawing back today. And that's exactly how it's expressed in Hebrews 10, beginning verse 35. Therefore, do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that after you have done the will of God, you may receive the promise. Yet a little while, and he who is coming will come, will not tarry. Now the just shall live by faith. But if anyone draws back, my soul has no pleasure in him. Now listen to these words of inspiration. But we are not of those who draw back to perdition, but of those who believe to the saving of the soul. Do you see the contrast? Those who draw back to perdition as opposed to those who believe to the saving of the soul. See how simple that is? That's the problem that was found in Israel. They really didn't believe God. God said, it's yours. I'll give it to you. And they didn't believe it. And for that, they fell in the wilderness. In fact, whenever the thing came forward, we find out that actually they became angry because that they were satisfied with the majority report. They didn't absolutely care about anything else. They liked that majority report. And consequently, that's what they were set on following after. But you know, this brings to mind a passage of scripture that I used to hear a lot from my mama. Exodus chapter 23 and verse 2. If you're not familiar with that, you might want to turn over to it and read it. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil. Well, that's exactly what these people did. They went with the majority. And where was the majority going? Well, they were doing evil in the sight of God. They fell right into that, didn't they? But not only did this cause a friction here, it actually records that they became angry at their opposition. In Numbers 14 and 10, all the congregation said, stone them with stones. And the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before the children of Israel. God let it be known that this wasn't going to happen. It's dangerous to blindly follow the crowd. And you know why? And this is sad. But a good part of the time, the majority is not right. That's one of the problems with majority rule. Many, many times, a majority are not right. Noah, you remember Noah? Was he in the majority or the minority? Oh, he was in the minority, wasn't he? Who was right? He was. The majority were dead wrong. Elijah stood alone against 450 prophets of Baal. Who was right? Well, Elijah was. And don't ever forget that Barabbas got more votes than Jesus. This should cause us to be cautious of the majority. Very cautious. And I think that's kind of a thing that we should always remember. We don't believe something or practice something just because the majority are doing it. Because so often the majority are doing wrong. We're more concerned about what's right in the sight of God, not what everyone's doing. But another thing that was a reason why that generation was lost is, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot, is that they magnified their difficulties. And what do we mean by this? Well, in their eyes, all they saw were the trials and the hardships that they would have to face. Look at all these people. They're huge. What are we going to do? Their cities are fortified. What are we going to do? It's too difficult. They didn't stop to think about the blessings and opportunities that were presented to them by God. And seeing giants and walled cities, what'd they do? They forgot about God. They forgot about His providence. You know, I'm reminded of the Apostle Paul. And over in 2 Corinthians 12, you know, he talks about having a thorn in the flesh. But you know, Paul had to forget about that and just deal with it. Why? Because he had assurance from the Lord that what he was doing was what God wanted him to do. And the thorn in the flesh was just a minor inconvenience. How many people today have a thorn in the flesh that they use as an excuse to keep from doing what they should be doing? Think about it. The thorn in the flesh that they have doesn't keep them from doing what they want to do. If they want to do it, that thorn's not so bad. But if it's something that might be uncomfortable or be a little bit extra effort for them and they really don't want to do it anyway, all of a sudden that thorn gets real big. Think about that. With every difficulty, God makes provision for His own. I'm always reminded, and this has always been one of my favorite passages in Romans 8 and verse 31. I'm always reminded of the assurance that Paul presents to us in this particular context. What shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Pretty hard to beat that, isn't it? And if they would have had that attitude when it came time to go in and to take the land that God had promised to them, they wouldn't have perished in the wilderness. That whole generation wouldn't have been lost. But they didn't have that attitude. But indeed, we're promised that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. Philippians 4 and verse 13. And then, of course, the words of assurance we find in Hebrews 13 and 6. We may boldly say, the Lord is my helper. I will not fear. What can man do to me? That kind of rings out very similar to what Romans 8:31 says, doesn't it? Yeah, exactly. We need to have that attitude. But another thing that caused this generation to be lost was they did not respect themselves. You remember what they said? We're like grasshoppers in our own sight. You know, we look at these people and they're so big. We're scared. They gave the children of Israel a bad report, saying that this land is so horrible that it devours its inhabitants. And there's giants there. Giants. They're scared to death. You know what they should have remembered? They should remember that they numbered 603,500 warriors who were to that point undefeated. Now think about that. They're standing there ready to go into this land with over 600,000 warriors. Undefeated. And they're scared. But you know why they were undefeated? That's the reason right there. God was with them. And he would have been with them if they would have gone in and taken the land. The same God who delivered them from Egypt by a mighty hand was still there. You know, displays of self-renunciation and self-humility do not mean that we are selling God short in any way. We must never underestimate, though, that which God has given us. Every one of us has abilities. God is always there, and God always has the power. But we all are blessed with abilities. And how often do we underestimate what God has given us? They didn't even think about that, did they? All they could see was giants. All they could see was giants. Probably kept them awake at night thinking about those giants. But they should have seen God and his providence and his promises to them. We need to remember in all situations our own worth before God. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. We know that when he is revealed, that we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. They kind of needed a shot of that in the arm, didn't they? They needed that. We're God's people. What are we afraid of? Do we need that sometimes? Well, maybe so. Maybe we need a little bit of that. But instead, what did they do? Oh, they murmured and they turned away from the authority that God had designated for them. In fact, we're told they planned an insurrection against Moses and Aaron. And consequently, that would have been against God, wouldn't it? Because Moses and Aaron were God's appointed authorities. Their constant whining and bickering provoked God. In Numbers 14:11, the Lord said to Moses, "How long will these people reject me? How long will they not believe me with all the signs that I performed among them?" You can hear God's frustration in this, can't you? What do I have to do for these people? And then he says, "I'll strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them. And I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they." Well, that's kind of like the way God felt at the base of Mount Sinai, wasn't it? Whenever the people built the idol and were worshiping the idol, He said, "Stand back, Moses. I'm going to wipe them all out. We'll just start over again." And of course, Moses interceded, and God relented, but did not keep him from punishing them, did it? He still punished them. But in all of this, facing this, these people never really offered anything constructive. Did you notice that? All they did was criticize what was offered to them. That's all they did. And you know what was another problem of these folks? They kept looking back and not looking ahead. They kept looking back and not ahead. In Numbers 14, the first three verses, the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. And the whole congregation said to them, "If only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness, why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" You see, what were they doing? They kept looking back. They kept looking back instead of looking forward. They remembered the experiences of the times before, but did not look forward with anticipation to what God held for them that was ahead. They didn't do it. And you know, there's a lot of admonitions about God's people needing to be those who look ahead. In Luke 9:62, Jesus said, "No one having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God." Pretty simple there. As long as you're looking back over here at Egypt, you're not going to get where you're going. Now, don't you deny it when you're driving down the road and something catches your eye and you start focusing on that. You're going to get a little bit off the line, maybe hit the bumper, you know, or you're going to have your co-pilot go, "Pay attention to what you're doing." You need a co-pilot for that, right? Well, that's what happens with a plow. Only with the plow, it's so important to keep your eyes looking ahead so that you'll plow a straight line, right? And that's the picture that Jesus paints here. In Colossians chapter 3, in the first two verses, Paul wrote, "If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above and not on things on the earth." What's he saying? Our ultimate goal is not found on this earth. For many people, it is, isn't it? Wealth or some particular possession that they are seeking, or possibly retirement so they can quit working and just kick back and get rich and all that money the government's going to send them. Oh, that doesn't happen, does it? That's right. But anyway, but that's, to some people, that's it. That's all there is. You know, you're born, you live, and you die. Oh, that's it. So you might as well grab all the gusto while you can. And that's how they live. But that's not the way Christians live. Our minds are set on things that are above, eternal things. Not just this physical realm. The spiritual realm, where God is, where Christ is, where the Holy Spirit is. That's where our goal is. And that's what we're taught. Looking ahead. But you know, another thing caused them to be lost. They were unwilling to pay the price. They considered the price to be too much. "You mean we have to go over there and take it? Why, that's not fair. Those people are big over there and they might be mean. That's just too much. God's asking too much of us." You know, I'm reminded that Jesus taught us some things about this. For one thing, he taught us that we need to be willing to meet God's demands. In Luke 9 and verse 23, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Those are pretty stringent demands, aren't they? Yeah, they are. They're very stringent. But you think that's stringent? Read this one. Romans 12, verses 1 and 2. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Try that one on. Give your body as a living sacrifice to God. But you know, many people today read those kind of things and they count the cost, but they're not willing to pay the price. They're not willing to pay the price. We've got to be willing. We've got to be willing. We have to be willing to do what the Lord requires of us. In Luke 14, by the way, and I know we've already touched a little bit on this in another context here, but in Luke 14, beginning verse 27, Jesus talks about those who come after him to bear their cross, and if they don't do it, they can't be his disciple. And then he goes on to say, which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it? If any of you are homeowners, you know about this. You may say, oh, I'd like to change this room, or I'd like to add on a room, or I'd like to remodel a room. What's the first thing you have to do? Sit down and figure out what it's going to cost. And in many cases, you sit down and figure out what it's going to cost, and then you realize that it ain't that bad as it is. You might just leave it alone, because it's going to cost a lot of money to change it. But we understand the idea of counting the cost. And every time I think about this, and I've probably mentioned this before, but you probably forgot it, so you won't remember I mentioned it. But every time I think about this, the laying of the foundation and not being able to finish, I think about this hill in Hemet. And it's kind of a mound, but, you know, in Hemet we called it a hill. But there is the foundation of a huge home up on top of this hill. And you know what happened? The fella had the foundation poured and then realized he didn't have the money to build. And the last time I was there were buffalo running around on that property. And there's still no house up there on the hill. People laugh about that, because he didn't stop to count the cost. And we understand how important that is. He also used the idea of a king going to war. He needs to make sure he's got enough people, you know, do the job. But likewise, in verse 33, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple. In other words, you better be willing to pay the price. You better be willing to pay the price. Paul, of course, we know about what he said over here in Romans 8, verse 18, where he says he considered the sufferings of this present time not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Now, you know, I don't think any of you, as far as I know, haven't been dragged outside the city and stoned lately. I don't think any of you have been beaten with whips or been put in chains in a dungeon. But you know what Paul said about that? The sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that will be revealed in us. We need to keep that attitude of heart as we face the trials and the temptations that come our way in this life. But you know, it's pathetic that an entire generation of people. No, it isn't just pathetic, it's tragic. That's a better word, it's tragic. That an entire generation of people died in the wilderness. Over the space of 40 years, every one of them died. But remember what we said in the beginning of the lesson? These things were written for your admonition. They are written for your learning. So, we must be willing to apply these thoughts to ourselves and take lessons from it for ourselves. We must remember that our learning and our admonition is important. We want to know how to deal with God, don't we? And you know, the New Testament writer in the book of Hebrews has somewhat to say about that in the 4th chapter of the book of Hebrews and the first 2 verses, and I'd like to read those for you. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest. Now, you know, the comparison here is between the people who were seeking the rest of the promised land and didn't get it. Now he says, there's a promise that we have that remains now of entering his rest, which would be the eternal rest. Let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, but the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. Listen to this. They heard the good news. God's going to give us a land. God's going to give us a land that flows with milk and honey. It's going to be ours. We're just going to go in there and we're going to take it. And they're all excited about that. But when it came right down to it, they lacked faith that God could deliver what he promised. And all they could see was giants. That's all. That's all they could see was giants. Well, what about us today? Do we believe that God can deliver what he promised? I think the way we live our lives pretty well tells whether we believe that or not. If we live our lives in a way that is in accordance with God's will, if we are looking beyond this life and to that which is above, directing our every step by the commandments that he has delivered to us in his inspired word, then we're showing our confidence. We believe God that it will be exactly as he said it would be. Now, what about those who don't do that, though? What about those who kind of like want to cover their bases, you know? Well, maybe God can do this and maybe he can't. So I'm not going to put too much effort into it because it might be a bust, you know. I don't want to waste my time. So they kind of straddle the fence and go down the middle of the road, kind of weaving along. At one point, that's good. I believe God, yeah. But, you know, I don't like this over here, so I'm going to do this over here. And that's how they live their life. What's going to happen to those people? Well, the same thing that happened to this lost generation. They're going to be lost. For all eternity. Lost. Notice the key. Not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. That's what the key right there. If we have faith in God, then we have faith that he will deliver what he promised. And that is motivation enough for us to keep his commands and to do his will, to deny ourselves, take up our cross daily, follow him, give ourselves as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God. And I could go on and on, right back over the lesson again. I'm not going to do it. But you see what I mean. Tie it all together. I hope this lesson is helpful to us. As I said, it was intended for us to think about exactly what inspiration says the purpose of the Old Testament was, and then making specific application to you and to me today in light of the things that took place with regard to the house of Israel of old. And we don't want to miss the promised rest. We want someday to claim heaven as our eternal home. We want to be in the presence of God forevermore. And that's how we live our lives here. With that idea in mind and with that view in sight. If you're not yet a Christian, we hope that you'll use this opportunity to allow us to assist you in your obedience to Christ. If you're a Christian, but you haven't been faithful to the Lord as you know you should be, we as brothers and sisters in Christ stand ready to pray with you and for you if that be your desire. Whatever your obligation to God might be, we extend the invitation and invite you to come while we stand and sing together.